Hello, and thank you for downloading Witness from the BBC World Service. It's 70 years since the largest jailbreak of World War II, when hundreds of Japanese prisoners of war tried to escape from a prison camp in the Australian outback. They decided they'd rather face death than the shame of returning to Japan as prisoners. Paul Schuster has been listening to accounts of that night from the Australian War Memorial Archive.
Winding back to an old-fashioned shack along the road to Gundagai.
It's August 1944, and all appears normal at the No. 12 Prisoner of War compound near Cowra in rural New South Wales, Australia, home to 4,000 mainly Italian and Japanese prisoners of war. Ashley Cooper from Sydney was one of the Australian soldiers guarding the camp, and several years ago he recorded his memories of how the Japanese prisoners were treated for the Australian War Memorial.
In their own compound, provided they didn't go within 6 feet, I think it was, of the inside perimeter fence, they were allowed to do what they wanted to do. Intelligence officers made available to them proper baseball bats because they were baseball enthusiasts. So they were given every opportunity to be made as happy as possible as a prisoner of war.
Former POW Yamada Masayoshi agrees.
Well, at night, the only thing we could do was sleep. But during the day, when we were not playing baseball, we were making baseball gloves. We were given 2 pairs of leather boots. We took the leather apart. We made the leather softer and made baseball gloves. I think we spent a lot of time making playing gear for baseball.
Masayoshi also spoke to the Australian War Memorial later. He recalled the day the Japanese prisoners were told some of them were going to be sent to a different camp, prompting a vote on whether they'd be better off attempting to escape.
The most shameful thing for us was to be captured alive. That's what had been drummed into us. We'd never met anybody who was a prisoner of war who had returned to Japan, so we thought no prisoner of war would ever return. But to be honest, I think I wanted to wait a bit longer. I wanted to see how the war would develop and see what happened and then decide. I wanted to cling to life. But once the decision was made to break out, I felt, okay, I will go along with it.
The breakout was planned for 2 o'clock in the morning on the 5th of August, 1944. Ashley Cooper was asleep.
I was at headquarters and I was pretty tired. I decided to go to bed early and have a good night's sleep. It was about 2 o'clock. This terrific noise going on. Machine guns going flat out, pistols going off, very lights going up in the air.
Keith McGuinness was one of the Australian guards on duty that night.
Coming over the fence, you didn't know whether it was fair dinkum or what was going on. The first wave of the Japs raced onto the barbed wire and laid on it, and the rest of them ran across them like a bridge. And that was it. We just sort of opened up on them and kept them hemmed in, and they couldn't get out of it.
Bullets were flying around like blowflies, zing, zing, zing. And I could see the huts alight in the Japanese compound. It was like a big bonfire, which when you come to think about it, what an idiotic idea for them to do, because they just stood out like silhouettes against this background of fire.
I couldn't get out of the camp. I was with those who climbed over the fence. The only thing we could do, however, was lie in the ditch. We just couldn't move at all. I had a baseball bat with me, as did my friend, but it was not to attack anyone. We talked before the breakout that if one of us was shot and very close to death, the other would hit him over the head and let him die as quickly as possible. But I didn't really expect to be alive after I'd climbed over the fence. I thought I'd be shot while I was climbing over it.
Lying nearby was fellow prisoner Takahara Marikuni.
Before the sun came up, the Australians were shooting, but once day broke, they stopped. Eventually, the gate was opened, and they told us to stand up. An Australian officer appointed me as an interpreter, and he asked me, or rather told me, to persuade the others to go back into the camp. So I did that.
By sunrise, hundreds of prisoners had escaped into the outback, but 3 Australian soldiers and 231 prisoners lay dead, mowed down in the attempt or, as guard Tom Cusack explains, having taken their own lives.
I'd never seen a dead body before in my life, and I saw 201 heap. Some threw themselves under the train, some hung themselves. We'd have shot the bloody lot of money for our colonel. He told me to ring all companies at daylight and tell them to cease fire.
The Japanese prisoners had agreed ahead of the breakout not to harm any local civilians if they did make it out of the camp. In the surrounding countryside, local residents were about to get the shock of their lives. 16-year-old Bruce Weir and his 14-year-old sister Margaret lived on a nearby farm.
I was outside. I noticed our mechanic coming down the path with three Japanese prisoners dressed in their maroon garb. My mother was making scones, and she said, what do they want, Stan? Very calmly. She said, they want food, Mrs. Weir. And she said, well, just take them round to the side veranda, and I'll be with you in a minute. I'll just finish making these scones. And then she turned to me, and she said, you race over and tell Auntie, who lived close by, to ring the military and tell them to come and pick them up.
When Margaret got back to the house, her mother was treating the prisoners the way she would any other house guests.
The Japanese prisoners were sitting down, and my mother was being the perfect hostess as always. She was serving them tea and scones. It was about 10 minutes they took to have their meal, and then they just got up and thanked my mother, and then they just sauntered off down towards the creek. Eventually the military came and they fired a few shots over their heads and they surrendered quite calmly. But then we only had to wait about a quarter of an hour. My father and Bruce came home. They weren't as calm as my mother was.
One of the prisoners was wearing a hat that was known to have come from the shearing shed. It was an old hat that my father wore. And so he assumed that they had been up at the shed and he decided to go and have a look there. I went with him. He had a shotgun and I had a 22 calibre rifle. I went into the shed and he went into the shearer's hut and I heard him call out. I came out and he had disturbed another prisoner in the hut. He had a piece of rope round his neck and apparently had been in the process of contemplating suicide by hanging. He rushed out past my father and stood possibly 10 yards from my father and I, and invited my father to shoot him. My father declined and beckoned to him to follow us, and he walked between my father and I back to the house.
It took 9 days to locate the hundreds of escaped prisoners. 334 were recaptured. Most came willingly, although one did attack and kill a soldier. Some were found hanged in local barns. Some even threw themselves in front of trains rather than surrender. But 40 years later, some of the Japanese survivors returned to Australia and the small outback community of Kaura. And Margaret Weir even got the opportunity to welcome back one of the three Japanese prisoners her mother had served tea and scones to all those years ago.
He was so excited to meet us and be back, and he remembered the place exactly. And he was pleased to see me, but disappointed that my mother wasn't alive, and he brought toys for her grandchildren, and he came straight into the house and made himself at home. And I told him that we still had the jug that my mother served tea to him, and his eyes nearly popped out when he saw it.
Margaret Weir, ending that report from Paul Schuster, featuring archive interviews from the Australia-Japan Research Project at the Australian War Memorial. And for our complete range of downloads and our terms of use, go to bbcworldservice.com/witness.